Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics. This one is about early career prodigies versus late bloomers. Now let's review the bidding. Mark Zuckerberg founded Facebook at age 19. Taylor Swift released her first album at 16. Malala Yousafzai won the Nobel Prize at 17. And Time Magazine now releases an annual list of most influential teens. The stories of success in the media get younger and younger, and we're pushing our kids harder and harder, so much so that the tutoring and test prep industry generates nearly $1 billion every year. Are our kids being pushed to the brink of breakdown? Is it right to discount any successes achieved after your 30 under 30 expiration date? What's the pressure like to achieve early, if not also often?
I mean, you look at precociously bright Silicon Valley people. Some of them take a bad turn, like Elizabeth Holmes at Theranos. I truly believe a lot of people think she's a born sociopath, and maybe she is. Maybe I'm wrong, but I prefer to give her the benefit of the doubt. I think she fell in love with her early blooming self. I mean, she was a prodigy at a young age, and then when the product wasn't working as they had hoped it would, rather than patiently going about trying to fix it, she lied.
Our mounting preoccupation with precocity has created a distorted, if not downright dangerous, narrative. If we or our children are not prodigies, we've failed. Turns out late blooming is where it's at. Here's the publisher of Forbes magazine and author of a new book on the late bloomer theme. Here we go.
Rich Karlgaard, publisher, Forbes magazine.
The book is called Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. So your book was an early achiever. Seems antithetical to your theme, but we can move past that. Let's talk about your story real quick, because you are a self-professed and qualified late bloomer. Is that right?
Yeah. Now, I'm a proud junior college graduate. Usually early bloomers don't go to junior colleges. And then I got into Stanford by a series of flukes. The cross-country track coach thought I was better than I was. I was from North Dakota. So somebody in the admissions department said, hey, we got a runner from North Dakota. Check that box. Good. Don't let any more like him in. And instead of taking advantage of that fantastically lucky break, I squandered it. I was a lackluster student, no motivation at all. I graduated the bare minimum number of units, and my grades are poor, and in what I call the Mickey Mouse curriculum, that is shopping in the catalog to see what are the easiest courses,
right?
Sleep and dreams and things like that.
Right.
And so at age 25, while my more ambitious early blooming roommates were off in law school, other kinds of graduate schools, I could hold no job greater than temporary typist, dishwasher, and security guard. And I remember a low point. One night I was a security guard at a trucking yard north of San Jose, and I heard a dog barking as I was making my rounds, and I swung my flashlight around, and there it was, a Rottweiler in the yard next door. And it occurred to me at age 25, my professional colleague was a dog. Months later, Steve Jobs, also 25, would take Apple public. So let's just say I became aware of a rather large gulf between his extraordinary accomplishments and the lack of my own.
Right.
But it was easier for me to bloom out of that. I bloomed. A temporary typing job led to a technical writer's job, and it was the first job I took seriously. And I was conscious of my brain and sense of responsibility awakening it around age 26 or 7. Mm. I think it was easier to do in my day. You probably can guess how old I am, because I'd be the same age as Steve Jobs if Jobs were still alive.
Right.
But I think it was easier in that day to do that, because you didn't have social media where everybody not only compares themselves to the curated versions of their colleagues and friends,
right. But
they typecast themselves as a result. You didn't have the extraordinary pressures. I mean, there's no way I could get into Stanford. I couldn't get into a UC for sure with my accomplishments in high school.
Right.
So I was fortunate. And now I think that this obsession with early achievement, and I think a lot of it is inspired by these extraordinary successes you see in the Valley. You see Mark Zuckerberg, you saw
right.
Sergey Brin and Larry Page starting Google, and there's so many of those that it leaves people wondering, well, what do I need to do the same? And if I don't, you know, what kind of a second-rate person I am? Am I? And you know, what do I need to do? Well, there's a pretty clear path. You get really high SAT scores, you get great grades, you go to an elite school, and you'll attract attention of somebody on Sand Hill Road in the venture capital environment, or some screener at Facebook or Google, or some promising startup, and that's the way it's done. Well, you know, it's good for whom it works, but it leaves the vast majority of us whose gifts are undiscovered in this sorting process, or were simply later to mature, as I was.
Right.
It makes, you know, we've needlessly created barriers for people like that to discover themselves and to prosper.
For here, there's so many things we could take on here. When I first started reading the book, I'm a parent of a 9-year-old daughter, and I read it almost as a parenting book in a lot of ways. And I took to heart an interview you had with a psychologist or a psychology professor at Stanford talking about the students that are coming in are, she said, we used the word brittle. What do you think is a solution to some of this? I mean, is there a macro broad stroke? We can't just tell people, like, don't push your kids, but at the same time, don't push your kids.
That's the decisions that all parents in high-achieving cities like San Francisco and Silicon Valley, they all go through that. Am I pushing them too much or not enough? The professor you're referring to is the great Carol Dweck, who wrote a book called Mindset a dozen years ago, and she described the incoming students at Stanford. She teaches a freshman psychology class as, quote, exhausted and brittle. They don't want to mar their perfect records. I'll tell you, Jason, that kind of spun me around because I think I was one of those baby boomers that looked at the millennials and thought, ah, they're all spoiled. They're snowflakes. They're slackers. They can't take a punch, you know. Back in my day, we walked to school 2 miles uphill against the wind, and
right.
And now they're driven everywhere, et cetera, et cetera. You hear that kind of carping all the time. I'll tell you, when you see higher rates of anxiety, depression, and suicide, exploding rates in some areas for teens and young adults, then kind of, you know, the idea of calling them snowflakes or slackers, it makes you feel really bad about yourself, and it should. I think that these are victims of this high-pressure cooker,
mm-hmm.
and some of them will pop out of that, and they'll be all the tougher for it. But many won't, and many will feel urged to go into careers for which they have no passion. There's a description of a woman who had suddenly made partner, or you know, after the long road to make partner at a prestigious Silicon Valley law firm, she went to bed crying every night, and. On the surface, this is a woman who looked like she was living the dream. She had a great undergraduate career. She went to Stanford Law School. She went to work for one of the elite Silicon Valley firms. She made partners. She was in the land of big bucks and big prestige.
Right.
And she hated it.
Right.
She went to bed crying every night.
Well, you know, you mentioned the millennials, most educated generation probably ever, but also probably not going to be as economically successful as those that came before. In that answer also, you mentioned another cohort. You're a member of the baby boomers. I'm a Gen Xer. But I'm noticing, too, that a lot of second careers are happening because of a couple of economic paradigm shifts. And one of them would be artificial intelligence. The other would be gig economy. Were you able to address that in your book, Late Bloomers, about the second careers that come around 50, usually sometimes, late 40s to 50?
Yes, I did, and I wanted to be very careful in this book. I spent 5 years doing the research and writing it because I wanted everything to be defensible from a scientific standpoint. So I got deep into neuroscience and psychology to see what is really going on here. And there was an enormously important study that came out of Harvard, MIT, and Massachusetts General Hospital in 2015, led by a woman named Laura Germain, that asked the simple question, at what age do we reach our peak cognitive abilities? And the answer is really intriguing and hopeful. And the answer is it depends on what cognitive abilities you're talking about because they evolve. There are certain decades where we do certain things better. For example, in our late teens and 20s, we reach our peak in our synaptic processing speed and our working memory. Well, that's great if you're going to be a software programmer operating, you know, under pressure. It's great to have those skills.
Mm-hmm.
It's not until our 30s, 40s, and 50s that our brain and our makeup begin to develop a whole set of abilities that make us better managers, executives, leaders, communicators, empathizers, all of those things it's good to have. I mean, you look at precociously bright Silicon Valley people, some of them take a bad turn, like Elizabeth Holmes at Theranos. I truly believe a lot of people think she's a born sociopath, and maybe she is. Maybe I'm wrong, but I prefer to give her the benefit of the doubt. I think she fell in love with her early blooming self. I mean, she was a prodigy at a young age. And then when the product wasn't working as they had hoped it would, rather than patiently going about trying to fix it, she lied. Or you look at Mark Zuckerberg. Now, Mark Zuckerberg is brilliant in so many ways, but boy, you put him under the lights testifying before Congress, and you see that he's got skills yet to develop.
Yeah.
And he will develop them over time. And so it's so wonderful. And then in our 50s and 60s, we acquire this kind of concept called wisdom, which the neurological explanation I got from one neuroscientist is it's simply the left and right hemispheres of the brain, you know, working out something where one side of the brain perceives one thing about the fact, and the other side of the brain, with its storage of memories and so on, thinks this about it, and it's kind of a back and forth, and you get this intuition that is wisdom. So, wow, if you can align your career to
right
to that trajectory, in other words, you're a technical expert when you're young, but if you miss that window, don't try to be a software programmer at 30 or 40. Move on, because your brain has.
Right.
And then, you know, we're natural coaches and mentors in our 60s and 70s.
This is fascinating. I love the brain science. The brain is a marvelous place. The early bloomer obsession, somehow making culture less diverse. Can you help me unpack that? Because that's a really interesting tenet you uncovered.
Well, think about San Francisco Bay Area. We celebrate our diversity, and we should. We should be rightly proud of the diversity, the tolerance, the acceptance, the encouragement we show for differently gendered people, for people of all kinds of skin colors and ethnicities. And we're great at that. But on the one level, I mean, that's good, but I think it blinds us to this utter lack of diversity and lack of tolerance for people who aren't cognitively gifted in a way that shows up on math SAT tests and whether you started a company at age 25. Even people like Steve Jobs, you know, would throw around words like bozo.
Right.
Vinod Khosla, the co-founder of Sun Microsystems and a celebrated venture capitalist, was once quoted saying that basically over 45, you're brain dead. And this gets passed along too easily in our high-performance San Francisco Silicon Valley culture. We're not diverse when it comes to that.
We've been speaking with Rich Karlgaard. He is the author of the new book, Late Bloomers, among other things, but the new book, Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. Good luck with the rest of the book tour, sir.
Thank you so much, Jason.
That's Rich Karlgaard. He's publisher of Forbes magazine. He's also a self-proclaimed late bloomer, and his new book is Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. For links to Rich and his new book, check the show notes at kgoradio.com and or the podcast notes. My thanks to Rich for his perspective on late bloomers. His book is doing well on Amazon, too. And my thanks to you for listening, as always. For executive producer Lee Hammer, I'm the host and the writer, Jason Middleton. This has been Techonomics. Have great weeks, everybody.